This is the fifth Sunday since the last time we talked about John. So whatever you've remembered or forgotten, I fully understand. We've worked our way all the way through chapter 11 down to verse 46. I'm going to read verses 47 through the end of the chapter, which is verse 57. And then we'll talk about this. John chapter 11, starting at verse 47. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? For this man is performing many signs." Remember, he had just raised Lazarus from the dead, according to the way John is presenting his book. "If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." Notice what they put first: their place, their positions, their job, their role in the nation. "But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people, and that the whole nation not perish.' Now he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they," chief priests and Pharisees, "they planned together to kill Jesus. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. So they were seeking for Jesus and were saying to one another as they stood in the temple, 'What do you think? Do you think that he will not come to the feast at all?' Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where Jesus was, he was to report it so they might seize him." What's interesting to me, before we get started in anything else, is that John is telling this part of the story of a group of people who wanted to get rid of Jesus, and the very next story is of anointing Jesus' feet with expensive perfume by somebody who adored Jesus. What a contrast. But that aside, one of the things I've tried to convey to you from the beginning of this study is that the first 11 chapters of John are primarily focused on stories that affirm Jesus' deity. Beginning at John chapter 11, verse 47, which is the section we just started, the focus switches. John switches the focus from stories that affirm Jesus' deity to the last days of Jesus' life. The rest of the book deals with the last days of Jesus' life. That includes his last Passover, his arrest, his judgment, his crucifixion, his resurrection, and some final words to his disciples. Today, it's my intention to comment on specific parts of verses 47 through 57. And then I want to talk about this particular issue: wanting something other than God more than God. So that's where we're going to end up: wanting something other than God more than God. Let's pray. Father, it's by the power of your Spirit and the indwelling work of your Spirit in your people that you have produced these manuscripts, which we are privileged to read and to study, to see you in these pages and to discern your ways, to understand what is in your heart and in your mind, as much as it is humanly possible to do so. Thank you for giving us this privilege. Speak to us today through this section. This is my prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Verse 47 begins by telling us that the chief priests and the Pharisees had joined together. And they were working together to get rid of Jesus, who was the real problem to them, or so they thought. It's interesting to me that one of the earliest stories in John's Gospel tells us about Jesus cleansing the temple. You may recall we got to that early on in the Gospel of John. And that story gives us a clear picture of what Jesus thought about the religious leaders of his day. Here in John 11, starting at verse 47, we get a clear picture of what the religious leaders thought about Jesus and the threat that they believed he was to them. And as I've already mentioned, what they feared most was that the Roman government would send an army down and remove them from their positions of leadership and power. And my guess is they feared this because those positions gave them influence, respect, public acclaim, and access to wealth. And they did not want to lose that. And what I would like us to consider here at the beginning of today's teaching is that such evils as pride, jealousy, greed, selfishness, the willful abuse of position and power, and even murder can exist in the hearts of those who lead God's people. These were religious leaders, and yet this is what was in their hearts. They were not naive unbelievers. They were not uneducated unbelievers. And it isn't that they hadn't heard the messages of Jesus. If they weren't there themselves, they at least sent people to go and listen and report back what Jesus was saying. So they knew the messages that Jesus was giving. These religious leaders were intentionally rejecting Jesus Christ in order to protect and advance their own self-serving interests. Moving on to verse 49, Caiaphas calls them to consider that it's expedient to just kill Jesus and save the nation. Well, save themselves. It's to their benefit. Well, they'll keep their positions and power and influence. And it would save the nation from the Roman Empire coming down, fearing that Jesus might start an insurrection and Rome wouldn't take that kindly and send the army. And what Caiaphas intended to say was that it would be better for the chief priests and Pharisees to put Jesus to death. This was the expedient move. This would be the right move. Because the last thing you would want is for Rome to make Israel a police state, where the Roman Empire controlled not just the people, but the religious system and religious leaders. However, John points something out that I think is good for us to be aware of. God moved into that moment when Caiaphas spoke and presented a prophecy through him. We know that unbelievers can prophesy simply from the fact that Jesus himself in the Sermon on the Mount said that many will say to me on that day, "Lord, Lord, did we not?" And one of the things they will have claimed to have done is prophesy. And he didn't question. He didn't say, "Well, no, you didn't really prophesy. You just thought you were." He said, "In spite of what you did, you lived a lawless life." So it's very easy to accept that God moved in Caiaphas by his Spirit and produced this prophecy. And John goes on to explain that this prophecy was not just limited to Israel. but that Jesus came to save and unify into one group, both Jews and Gentiles. At least that's how the early church understood it. And that's what came to be known as the church, this new group. I would encourage you to look at Ephesians chapter 2, 11 through 22, just to get the picture of what John was enlarging as he enlarged on Caiaphas's prophecy. Well, from that day on, these religious leaders planned to kill Jesus somehow, some way. And what I want to point out here is that though these men were planning to put Jesus to death, it was God who ordained that Jesus would die. They were not simply acting outside of God's will, God's power, God's work in our world. They were planning Jesus' death, that's true, and they were figuring out all the details. And they did pull off their plan. They succeeded. But it was God who ordained that Jesus would die, not them. And it was God who picked the time and place, not them. And as Jesus said in John 10, he himself would lay down his own life and he would take it up again. So man plans, but God ordains. We are truly safe in God's hands. Jesus Christ could not have been put to death before God ordained that death to take place. All right, let's switch gears. Last Sunday, I asked you to think about why the Pharisees and the chief priests did not believe in Jesus. Now, to be fair, it was not all the Pharisees and chief priests who did not believe. We know that a few religious leaders believed in Jesus, such as Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea, and a few others who were part of the Sanhedrin. That was the ruling group of religious leaders in Israel. And we know there was others of the Sanhedrin because John chapter 12, which we haven't gotten to yet, verses 42 and 43 tells us that. However, we can say that most of them, from our understanding of the scriptures, most of them did not accept Jesus as sent from God and therefore did not believe in him. And the question is why? Were they simply evil men? Well, not according to Paul's description of the Jewish religious leaders of his day, and he was living in the time of Christ. Paul describes them, the religious leaders of his day, as trusting in the law, being proud of their God, not in a negative way, but in a good way. They were proud that Jehovah was their God. These are religious leaders who knew God's will, who were able to tell right from wrong because they were students of the law. And Paul goes on to say that because they were convinced the law embodied all knowledge and all truth, they were confident in their ability to be a guide to the blind, a beacon to those in darkness, a teacher of the ignorant, and an instructor of the unlearned. And you can read that in Romans chapter 2, verses 17 through 20. Now it's true he goes on to condemn them for not living up to what they were, but when he's describing them, he's not simply putting them down, he's describing them as a pretty good lot of people. In many ways, these chief priests and Pharisees were devout, law-keeping men. And yet, with all their devotion to God, with all their knowledge of God, with all their education in the Old Testament scriptures, with all their disciplined practice of Judaism, they still did not accept or believe in or follow Jesus. Why? Could their problem have been legalism? After all, we often hear that the great evil of the Pharisees was legalism. In fact, the Pharisees are used as the primary example of a legalistic lifestyle that we Christians are to avoid at all costs. But if the Pharisees and chief priests were so devoutly legalistic, why were they so willing and even eager to break the law by putting an innocent man to death? And we know from the Gospels that their law-breaking neither started nor ended with putting Jesus to death. We only have to read the woes from Jesus about the religious leaders to know that. Well, apparently, though they were devout in their keeping of the law, they were not devoutly committed to keeping the whole law. In other words, they were religiously double-minded, and their righteousness was riddled with duplicity. They wanted to look like godly followers of Yahweh, and at the same time, they wanted to participate in things that competed with the law for their allegiance, and they even wanted to participate in things that the law forbid. So yes, they were devout law keepers, but they were not devoutly committed to keeping the whole law. And so the reality is their problem was not legalism, but double-mindedness. Double-mindedness toward God. And their problem was duplicity. Duplicity in their practice of righteousness. Jesus confirms this when he said, "Our righteousness must surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees if we are to enter the kingdom of heaven." Matthew 5:20. Notice he never said, "Now you need to stop being legalistic and start being godly, righteous, having the righteousness of Christ." No, he said, "Your righteousness, my righteousness, our righteousness must exceed, surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees." Well, what makes righteousness surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees? Well, like them, we must at least be righteous and pursue righteousness. They did. But unlike them, we must want to be holy, totally, in all our ways, righteous. And then we must pursue righteousness in all our behavior. Peter brings this up in his letter when he says that as God is holy, we are to be holy in all our behavior. Well, considering the Pharisees and chief priests as being human beings like ourselves, it seems to me that one of the greatest challenges we face as Christians is not legalism, but double-mindedness toward God and duplicity in our practice of righteousness. What I'm hoping you can see here is that the reason these religious leaders did not believe in Jesus, and the reason they were unwilling to break, the reason they were willing, to break the law by killing Jesus, is because they wanted something other than God more than God. This doesn't mean that they didn't want God at all. But what it does mean is that there were times and situations where they wanted something other than God more than they wanted God. In all fairness, I think we can say that there were certain times and situations where God was supreme in their thinking and living. And that's commendable. Yet we see from this story here in John that when their positions of leadership, influence, power, prestige, and income were threatened, They neglected to keep God in that supreme position, and in fact they pushed him down, relegated God to a lesser position, and elevated their earthly, fleshly, and selfish interests to a position of supremacy in their thinking and living. And when we do this, we are being double-minded. Double-minded in relation to the supremacy of God in our life. We are being double-minded in relation to trusting in God and trusting what God says. We are being double-minded in giving allegiance to God. We give it when we want to, and we take it away and give allegiance to something else when we think something else is better than God himself, or what God says, or what God is doing. And we become selfish, self-serving, and disobedient to God when we do this. In my experience, there are many who believe in God. And in so doing, they seek to live according to what God says, as long as. See, the as long as is the important part here. There are many who believe in God, and in so doing, they seek to live according to what God says, as long as they feel safe and secure in doing so. Or as long as they are able to satisfy certain self-serving interests or certain longings for pleasure. Yes, they believe in God, but only so far, only so long, in only so many situations, in only so many ways. But on the other side of that, though there are many who believe in God, there are some who believe God. And there is a difference. We can believe in God, in his existence, without believing God himself. To believe God in the fullest, most complete way is to believe God implicitly. And those who do believe God give evidence to their trust of God by living according to what God says, even when they feel unsafe or insecure in doing so, and even when they must forsake some of their interests or lose out on some of their desired pleasures. The three friends of Daniel, they trusted God implicitly. Whether we live or die, they said, we will not worship any other God than Jehovah. And they had no knowledge that they would come out of the fiery furnace, though they were well aware they were going into it. That's believing God. I think we can rightly say that these Pharisees and chief priests believed in God, but they were not willing to believe God fully and implicitly. And they gave evidence to this reality by wanting some things other than God himself, and wanting those things more than God himself. And that's why they were willing to murder the Son of God. So with these things in mind, I want to turn our attention away from the Pharisees and chief priests, because it's easy to point out their shortcomings, and then walk away feeling pretty good about ourselves because we at least haven't done what they've done. And so in an effort to encourage you to look at yourself, I want to present you with two questions. First, is there one thing, just one thing, Or are there several things that are not God, yet you want them more than God? Is there one thing, or are there several things that are not God, yet you want them more than God? And the second question is this: might it be true that though you believe in God, you struggle with believing God in all things and in all ways? Might it be true that though you believe in God, you struggle with believing God in all things and in all ways? I think it is important to say that you are not alone in being challenged by these two questions, if indeed they challenge you. I too have been and continue to be challenged by these two questions. I know from personal experience how alluring, how gratifying, how captivating, and therefore how tempting some things are that I ought not to want. And yet I have wanted them. And I know from personal experience how easy it is to overlook or even justify participating in things that are not God, yet I have wanted more than God. I've justified sinful behavior on the basis of my wife's behavior. Imagine that. As if what she does gives me the right to go off and do what I have done. And this doesn't mean that I didn't want God, for I did. I have. I do. What this means is that I have been double-minded toward God, and I have had to face and deal with that reality. Memorizing James 4, 1-10 has been a blessing in my life for a variety of reasons, but the last several verses call me to account in ways that if I hadn't memorized those words and pondered them day after day for some number of years, I possibly wouldn't have been called to account. Well, my own sinfulness doesn't mean that I haven't wanted to be godly or that I haven't pursued righteous living, because I have. And I do. That only goes to show my propensity toward duplicity in my practice of righteousness. I was talking with a fellow who had a particular sin in his life. And this particular sin had a pretty powerful grip on him. And he would commit this sin Tuesday through Thursday. Not every day, but Tuesday through Thursday. And then he would put a stop to it because he knew he had to get up and lead worship or teach on Sunday. And he didn't want to go into Sunday having committed that sin on Saturday, because he knew that that would prevent God from speaking through him or working through him, or may inhibit the church from whatever it was he was trying to do with them. So we talked about that, how foolish and stupid that is. But he was living that way. Now, why was I so able to understand his story and to give him wise words of counsel? Because I too have been that person. I have pursued righteousness and yet been double-minded and practiced duplicity in relation to that, to my shame. the loss of the church, to the dishonor of God. And of the many things my own struggles have taught me, the one I want to make clear today is that when I choose something other than God over God, I am pushing God away and choosing the path of unbelief and selfishness. I'm not just committing a sin as if I have this little moment of disruption in my life. No, I am actually pushing God away. It took me a while to realize that. No, I don't mentally, start the sin by saying, okay, God, I'm going to push you away. But the reality is, I push God out of my mind. I act as if he's not there. And I choose the path of unbelief because I don't believe at that moment that God's ways really work, that they are truly the best way, that they're the only path of life. And that every other path leads to death. I'm not believing that at that moment. I'm believing that this, whatever it is I'm about to do, is going to bring me some measure of life, happiness, fulfillment, pleasure, whatever else it is that I'm after. One of the things that God has helped me see very clearly is that when I choose this path of unbelief and selfishness, the selfishness is made clear because I am not doing it for God's sake. I'm not doing it for my family's sake. I'm not doing it for your sake. The reality is, the only person's sake for which I'm doing it is my sake. And that's selfishness. The reality is, any other way than God's way is the way of spiritual loss. It's the way of destruction of some kind. Whether it's destruction in a relationship or destruction in your own character or destruction in the way you handle a situation and its outcome. A way other than God's way is the way of spiritual loss and destruction of some kind and death in some way. Things die when we go ways other than God's way. All right, this brings me back to you. Where are you in relation to wanting things other than God more than God? Where are you in relation to both believing in God and believing God? Have you won all these battles? Have you gained the victory? Or are you still fighting them? And if it is that you're still fighting them, my encouragement, my urging to you is to press on, to not give up, to not let down, to not grow weary, to not think it's hopeless, but to press on, and by God's empowerment and grace, to finally defeat and remove double-mindedness in your relationship with God. And duplicity in your practice of righteousness. It may take longer than you would like, but I'm urging you, press on. Don't quit. Don't give up. In light of the two questions that I asked you, I would like to help you see that there's two sides to those questions. There's the openly evil side, and there is the more subtle, sinister side. We want something other than God, more than God, in an openly evil way when we want things that God forbids. Just like the Pharisees and chief priests, just like me. They wanted to commit murder in order to solve their problem. I have wanted to do forbidden things in order to solve what I thought was my problem. We see the same thing in the first sin recorded in the Bible. Eve wanted what was forbidden more than she wanted God. And I don't know exactly what Adam wanted. I don't pretend to have the answer. I just have some thoughts about it. But whether he wanted the forbidden knowledge, like Eve, or he wanted Eve herself, he didn't want to lose Eve. Because if he didn't eat, and Eve was cast out, he was there alone again. So I don't know for sure what he really wanted. But he knowingly chose something forbidden by God over God himself. Then there's Achan, who wanted some of the forbidden treasures of Jericho more than he wanted God. Riches were his attraction. And more than wanting God, David wanted to be intimate with another man's wife. And he was willing to murder her husband to hide his sin. And he knew that both adultery and murder were forbidden evils. And we could go on. But again, looking at other people's lives should only open up our own thoughts to what is in our own life, not being able to say, wow, they were terrible people. I would remind you that David only committed adultery once, as far as we know. Some of us have looked far more than once and lusted. Oh, that we had only done it once. That would be a really good thing. My point is this. Sometimes we want forbidden things more than we want God. Imagine that. But it's real. It's true. It's what we all are tempted to do. Or at least I have been. And if we go after them until we get them, we get what we want. But we will also get troubles and hardship and sorrows and loss, which we don't want. But by then it's too late. You see, the devil holds out all the treasures and pleasures to begin with, and then you pay the price after. Which brings me back to you. Would you at least think about the question, are you participating in something that God forbids? If so, are you willing to elevate God to his rightful place of supremacy in relation to that forbidden thing? However, forbidden things are not the only things we want more than God. Sometimes we want things or relationships that are not just allowed, but they're good. In and of themselves, they are good. And yet because they compete with God for his position of supremacy over our choices and behavior, or because we go about getting them in the wrong way, they become a threat to our spiritual well-being, just like Delilah was a threat to Samson's well-being. For example, the scripture tells us that Abraham had a beautiful wife. And we know about at least two times when he feared for his life because of her beauty. Now, there's nothing even slightly wrong with wanting to live rather than to be murdered because your wife is beautiful and another man wants her. In fact, it's probably a good thing to want to live. But instead of trusting God with his life, Abraham told his wife to tell a partial lie about her relationship to him. Tell them, you're my sister. Well, she was. It's not a total lie. But she was more than Abraham's sister. She was Abraham's wife. And in having her tell this partial lie, he put her in a position that was not a loving position. It was a position where she might be forced or enticed to commit adultery. And so we see that Abraham wanted something that was good. He wanted to live. He didn't want to be murdered. But he wanted to live so much that he went about securing his life in a way that said he wanted his life more than he wanted God. Ananias and Sapphira sold a piece of land, and they chose to give part of the proceeds to the Lord and the work of the church. This is really a good thing. It was their land. They could do whatever they wanted with it. They chose to sell it. And they chose to give money to the Lord and the work of the church. However, they also wanted the praises of men. They wanted to appear as really godly people. And so they inferred that they were giving the whole amount for which they sold the land to the Lord and the work of the church. The reality is they were under no obligation to give any of that money to the church. They could have kept it all for themselves. It was nothing wrong with that at all. The fact that they wanted to give it, a good thing. The fact that they wanted the praises of men more than God, that's where a good thing turned bad. That's where they went astray. My point is, even when we want good things, there is the possibility of pursuing them or obtaining them in a way that makes them more important to us than God Himself. I want you to like me. I want you to want me to be your pastor. But if I lie to you to make you happy with me, what I want is no longer God, but your approval and acceptance. If I'm unwilling to risk offending you in order to tell you the truth, I don't want God more than I want your approval and acceptance. It's turning a good thing into a bad thing. When we turn good things into bad things, we are pushing God away just as much as when we choose a forbidden thing. And we are choosing the path of unbelief and selfishness. So wrapping all this up, once again, why did the chief priests and Pharisees reject Jesus? It was because they wanted something other than God, more than God Himself. And my encouragement to you is to think about this in your own life. Let us not throw stones at them. Let us take the time to reflect on ourselves. And let me remind you that this is not about living a perfect, sinless life. And I'm not suggesting we should condone or justify or take a casual approach to sin in our life. But only Jesus Christ lived a perfect, sinless life. You see, this is about your mindset. This is about the direction you are choosing for your life. The religious leaders of Jesus' day, they were choosing a direction for their life which was something other than God Himself. Yeah, they believed in God. They were religious. They did a lot of right things, a lot of good things, commendable things. We should be as zealous as them. But their mindset, the direction of their life, it was all about themselves, not God. And so I want to encourage you to nurture the mindset of wanting God more than anything else. Nurture that mindset and then seek to live that mindset out. And where you find yourself failing, confess that, make it right, get back up, and keep living out that mindset of wanting God more than anything else. And I want to encourage you to pursue godliness in a way that removes hypocrisy, duplicity. Duplicity is wanting to be seen as righteous, even though duplicity in righteousness is wanting to be seen as righteous, even though we realize we have areas where we are unrighteous, which is hypocrisy. So let us pursue righteousness with wholeheartedness. Make that your mindset. Make that the direction of your life. You may never reach perfection in this life. Not that I have obtained it or I've already become perfect, Paul said, but I press on. And that's what I'm encouraging us to do. Wanting something other than God, more than God, I believe that's a challenge we all face. Humans everywhere face that. But we can make good choices in spite of the challenge, the temptation, the world, our flesh, and all the things the devil wishes to throw at us.